Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Mine does filtered water and filtered sparkling water too, both chilled, which is ideal. If you can afford one, I highly recommend it. Go to cooker.co.uk, Cooker spelled Q-U-O-O-K-E-R. I also want to thank them for sponsoring my new platform, lovejoy.co.uk. As you might know by now, this is a platform where I talk about health, fitness, navigating your way through life. I'm taking the knowledge from my experts from these podcasts and putting it on the platform where you can consume it and hopefully become wise. As I always say, I've got many more questions than answers, so hopefully the experts will answer some of your questions. There's new content on there as well. It's just not all from the podcast. So, you know, there's new stuff we're putting up all the time. There's stuff about sleep and diet and exercise and mental health, you know, just how you can navigate your way through life. We're desperate for you to join in. We'd love to hear your feedback. Let us know what you think by emailing me at tim@lovejoy.co.uk. If you want to comment on anything to do with the podcast as well, we're just going to use this email from now on. It's tim@lovejoy.co.uk. Also, any guest suggestions, because I've had quite a few great guests on this podcast purely from you guys saying, get them on your podcast and speak to them for an hour. So that's what I've done. So today's hour, I'm curious about regret. And joining me to talk about this is Daniel H. Pink, author of the book, The Power of Regret. Daniel H. Pink is the author of various bestsellers, Drive to Sell Human and When. He also served as chief speechwriter for Vice President Al Gore. That's pretty cool. Hello, Daniel. How are you?
Hello, Tim. I'm good. Thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, absolute pleasure. I love that bit. I interviewed Al Gore once, and I was so impressed by that man. He was talking about climate change, and he was over here, and he's doing some promo. And they said, you know, you've got 2 minutes with him, or like 3 minutes or something. And I started asking some questions, and he said, no, I want to speak more about this, because I sort of went a little bit left field. And I thought, that's really great that he was so engaged that the people were trying to wind him up, but he didn't want to because he wanted to give answers. And for that, I thoroughly enjoyed his company, and I think he's a great man.
You're a good assessment. You're a good judge of character. I agree with you.
So can I just ask you very quickly before we get onto the book, then what it's like writing speeches for someone like Al Gore? How does that actually work? What's the process like?
Well, it depends. It depends on the kind of speech that there is. I mean, these politicians give a lot of speeches, and some of them, I mean, to be perfectly frank, matter more than others. And so some of them have much more tender, loving care than others. So there are a few where I would just write it, rip it out of my printer, and hand it to him, and that was it. That was somewhat terrifying. And then there are other times where, for bigger speeches, where there's a longer planning process, multiple outlines and drafts, and other people weighing in, and more drafts, and more people weighing in, till you get something that ends up being rewritten entirely the night before.
Yeah, and as we know, words are important. We're having a lot of speeches at the moment in the world, and we're hanging on every word because it's important what people are saying. I'll ask you one more question, then I'm going to get onto your book. If he'd got into power,
sure,
instead of George W. Bush, would the world be a different place now?
I actually think it would. I mean, that's not necessarily a searing criticism of George W. Bush, but I think it would be a different place. I think that we might have taken action on climate change. When I say we, I mean Americans, but even the world. I think we might have taken action on climate change. And I think that for the, I say this as an American, I think there's a 0% chance we would have gotten involved in Iraq. 0%. And that turned out to be a colossal failure.
Yeah, I think when I interviewed him, I can't remember now how many years ago it was, but he was huge on climate change. And that was the real thing that he wanted to get across. And I think having the one of the biggest powers, if not the biggest power in the world, focused on climate change, I think things might have looked a bit different in the world. But, you know, it is what it is, and we are where we are. And do the American people regret not voting him in? What a brilliant segue into your book. Tell us
nice
about your
segue.
Thank you.
Wow.
tell us about the book. Why did you write The Power of Regret?
Well, I wrote it because, Tim, because I had regrets of my own. that I was dealing with. And I sort of reached a point in my life where I looked backward and said, whoa, my gosh, I have a lot of mileage on me, which is kind of a surprise. And as I was reflecting, I realized that my kids were getting older. My older daughter had graduated from university. And I started thinking about, wow, like time is really passing fast. If only I had worked harder in university, if only I had been kinder to people. And I felt sort of bad about these regrets, but I started talking to some friends of mine about them. And what I got a very interesting reaction, and that people, they leaned in. They wanted to talk about, I mean, they literally leaned in physically. They moved forward while wanting to engage on this topic. And I thought, this is peculiar, because this is not something we're supposed to talk about. And it was one of those ideas that I couldn't get out of my head. And I realized that once I looked at some of the academic research that we'd gotten this emotion wrong. And actually, I was actually writing an entirely different book. And I put it aside and decided to devote the next few years of my life to regret.
What were you writing about then?
Oh, it was a book about it was a book about social psychology. And it was really about what are the... the idea was is that if you had to write a guide to human beings, what would it say to explain our peculiar species to someone who had no idea what human beings were?
I absolutely love the idea.
It's a pretty clever idea, but
yeah, yeah.
Well, thank you. But I think that regret felt more urgent. It felt more personal. And it was something that I was trying to sort out myself. There's an old line in social science, even in natural sciences, saying that all research is me search. And I think that was the case for me.
I love that. Regret is clearly, by the way, I want you to write that other book soon because I just love the idea of that. But
on it. As soon as we're done with this conversation, I'll start working on it. You got it, Tim.
You start your book brilliantly by having people tattoo all over themselves, no regrets. It's a very popular tattoo. A third of people with tattoos regret having a tattoo, which I think it was a third. I can't remember the figures now, but it amuse me that because we are constantly told, have no regrets. This is the stance we should take. Why shouldn't we have no regrets? What is the problem with that theory?
The problem with that is that that's not how our brains work, and that's not good for us. So it is inconsistent with who human beings are and colossally bad advice. So what we know from 60 years of science, and when I say science, I mean social psychology, developmental psychology, cognitive science, neuroscience, what we know is that everybody has regrets. Regret is one of the most common emotions that human beings have. It's arguably the most common negative emotion that human beings have. When you look at people who actually don't have regrets, if you go searching for people who truly have no regrets, you know who you'll find? You'll find 5-year-olds because their brains haven't developed. You will find people with certain kinds of brain damage because their brains are injured. And you will find sociopaths. That's it. Everybody else has regrets. It's a fundamental part of the human condition. It's one of the most common emotions that we have. Everybody has regrets. And so there's a puzzle here, which is like, if everybody has this thing and it's unpleasant, why the hell do we have it? Like, you know, it seems like are we masochists? No. The reason we experience this negative emotion so ubiquitously is because if we treat it right, it's useful. It helps us. It clarifies what we value and it instructs us on how to do better.
Okay, so I suppose that at this point we need to define regret because obviously language is a complicated thing. There's other words which come into the category with regret, like mistake or disappointment. What defines regret against those two?
Yeah, that's a really good way to look at it. So let's take something like mistake. I can make a mistake and not regret it. All right. So let's say that I said. So I'll give you an example just literally moments ago. So before we, I'm staying here in London and I went out to get a cup of coffee and there was a farmer's market and there were these little, there was a stand selling these pockets, these like p- pockets of with savory stuff in it. And I said, okay, should I get the chicken chorizo or should I get the steak cheddar? And I got the steak cheddar and it wasn't very good, okay? That was a mistake. I should have gotten the chicken chorizo, all right? But I'm not going to regret that. The thing is, like, I'm going to forget about that in 10 minutes, all right? So that's a mistake, but it's not lingering with me. It's not sticking with me for a long time, all right? That's what regret has, some endurance to it. People regret things that they did or didn't do, not half an hour ago, but a month ago, a year ago, a decade ago, 2 decades ago. So you have the endurance. That's what. So not all mistakes trigger regret. Second, on disappointment, that's a really good point. Regret requires agency. Regret is your fault. Regret is your fault. So here I am. Okay, give you another. Okay, I mean, I'll give you my own life here. Say, so amazingly, I'm here in London. I'm an American, you know, as you can tell by my accent and overconfidence.
Sorry.
So shockingly, it's raining here in London. What a surprise, okay? So I might be disappointed that it's raining, but I might regret the fact that I regret the fact that on my way over here, I didn't pack an umbrella with me, all right? So it's not my fault that it's raining. That's external, but I had some agency over whether to bring an umbrella or not, and I didn't, so I regret that. Hmm. So regret is a mistake that endures that is your fault, where you look backward and you say, if only I had done this or not done that, my condition today would be better. So it's a negative feeling that that involves looking backward, feeling bad about actions or inactions of the past, and then wondering how the present would be different had you done something differently in the past.
It's only your brain, though, which is deciding these factors. Because let's take the beef and the chicken. Your brain has decided you made a mistake. However, the chicken might be worse than the beef. So you have not. There's no reality in that thought process.
You're right. That's a good point. It's possible that the chicken could have been worse. I don't think so, though, on this one, because you didn't eat what I just ate. But you get the idea that all mistakes don't trigger regret. All mistakes don't trigger regret. And that's actually really important, because this is actually a really important distinction, Tim, and it's very revealing about why regret matters. So if you make a mistake and it disappears and you don't think about it again, that tells you something. It tells you that it wasn't an urgent and essential part of your life or your values or your aspirations. But if you make a mistake and it sticks with you and sticks with you and sticks with you, that's telling you something. That's a signal. It's a signal about what you value, and it's offering sort of a knock at the door saying you should do things a little bit differently.
You got well stuck into this this topic. You created the World Regret Survey, collecting regrets from 1,600 people in 1,600 people in 16,000 people, sorry.
16,000.
Yeah, 16,000 people.
Yeah, order of magnitude off. 16,000.
Yeah, yeah. Apologies for that. I've written it down as 1,600, and that's bad of me.
I want you to say 16,000 because I read through them all, so I want credit for those other 15,400 that I read.
People
14,400 that I read.
People love offering up regrets, don't they? That is the conclusion.
You're exactly right about that. You're exactly right about that. With almost no promotion, we suddenly had this mountain of regrets submitted from people all over the world about what their biggest regret was.
Before we get into the details of what the regrets are, because I know you've got four core regrets and then other ways of looking at it. People listening to this will go, you know, anyone who's listened to a bit of Stoicism or Buddhism will say that, aren't you just punishing yourself by reliving it? And if you're sinking yourself into the past, won't that end up ruling your future?
That's possible if you do it right, if you do it wrong. And this is the key. This is the key, that no one ever teaches us how to deal with negative emotions. So one path is to say, ignore your negative emotions. Ignore them, forget about them, get past them. They're not telling you anything. That's a bad idea. But a worse idea is what you're describing, Tim, which is that you become captured by them. You wallow in them. You ruminate on them. You bathe in them. You luxuriate in them. That's a worse idea. What you want to do with negative emotions is think about them, confront them, and especially this negative emotion, because this negative emotion is our most transformative. Because, as I said before, when you feel regret, it's telling you something about what you value, and it's giving you guidance about what you should do next. And so, in a way, you mentioned those no regrets tattoos. People with no regrets tattoos might as well be wearing tattoos that say no learning, no growth. Because if you don't acknowledge your regrets, you're not going to learn. But if you go too far, you're exactly right, you're going to be brought down by them. What we have to do is take an approach that we haven't been taught about thinking about our regrets, confronting them. We have this idea that saying no regrets and always looking forward is a demonstration of courage. It's not. Real courage is looking your regrets in the eye and doing something about them.
Yeah, I think the thing that I'm picking up here, which I love the most, is the word values. Because I've spent a long time now on trying to improve myself as a human being. And my regrets are always, they're quite short-lived regrets, if I'm honest with you. But there'll be things that I do that I think, that doesn't fit my values. Why did I just do that? So, for instance, I might get angry with a shop assistant and think, why am I doing that? They've turned up to do their job, put myself in their shoes. How is that really fair? Right, Tim, come on, start thinking about it. And I think that's the big one that I'm picking up here, that a lot of regrets are things that have gone against your values, and that's why you're looking back and going, this is not me, this decision I made does not represent me. Is that what you're saying? Is there truth in that?
Yeah, it's a nice way to put it. I'll put one tweak on it, sort of a version of what you're saying. This does not represent the best version of me, and I want to be the best version of me.
Okay, I love that. So, because the thing with decisions,
because it might here's the thing: if I do something stupid, it actually might be an accurate representation of who I am. But it's probably not an accurate representation of who I want to be and who I can be.
Yeah, that's what I juggle with every day. And then I lie in bed at night and think, what did I do today that I don't want to be? Well, that's not who I am. And that does happen to me. And I'm still desperately trying to turn myself into a guru. And it's just not working. I'm far too human for it. So so there you go. I suppose with every regret probably comes about from a decision. Decisions, I suppose it's the consequences from the decisions that you regret. But I mean, a lot of bad decisions are equal great adventures. So, you know, my sort of Buddhist teaching side or Stoicism side thinks that even if there's a bad outcome, it doesn't really matter because it's still an adventure I've gone on, and it's still a case of me learning a lesson. Is that true?
That's a way to think about it, and that's in some ways a psychologically healthy way to think about it. So let me give you some specifics from all these massive numbers of regrets that I've collected from around the world. You have people who say there's a way to actually make yourself feel better about certain kinds of regrets by doing what's called a downward counterfactual, or what I like to call an at least. So I see it in this database of regrets that I have. Some people say, mostly women say, I regret marrying that idiot, but at least I have these two great kids. So they wouldn't want to, say, live in a world without these two great kids. And they recognize there was a benefit, but they still recognize that was a stupid decision. And they regret that decision. And so even if the decision led to an okay outcome, it's possible to scrutinize that decision and make better decisions in the future. What did I do wrong in marrying that person? Maybe I didn't know myself well enough. Maybe I was too rash in getting involved. Maybe I wasn't in a good financial situation or whatever. And so it's possible to be okay with the outcome of your life and still have regrets about decisions that you made. Indeed, particularly in one category of regret that I saw, people were actually not very outcome focused. They were focused much more on the decision itself. And that was particularly true with regrets about, particularly true with regrets of inaction, and particularly true with regrets about boldness.
Okay, I tell you what we should do. By the way, I want to point out I'm not a Buddhist. I just ended up reading a lot of Buddhism because I kind of I'm attracted to it, and Stoicism. So I like the Stoics as well because I like the way they talk. So let's go through. Should we go through the four categories? Because I think that would be the helpful. The four core regrets. I suppose the first one is the foundation regrets.
Right. So let me tell you how I got to this. Ordinarily, when scholars have studied regret and they're looking at what people regret, they focus on the domains of life. So this is a career regret, this is an education regret, this is a finance regret. And what my argument is that underneath those domains of life, there's a deeper structure of regret. What I found is around the world, there were four big categories. As you say, the first one is foundation regrets. Foundation regrets are, if only I'd done the work. And so these are regrets that people have about saving too little and spending too much, regrets about bad health choices, regrets about smoking, regrets about not working hard enough in school or university. So there are small decisions that people make early in their lives that accumulate, gather force, and have negative consequences later in life. So those are foundation regrets. The second category, I mentioned these just a moment ago, boldness regrets. Boldness regrets are, if only I'd taken the chance. If only I'd taken the chance. Now, these span domains. So these are people who regret not traveling when they had the opportunity. People regret not speaking up. People regret not asking somebody out on a date. People regret not starting a business. They're at a juncture. You can play it safe. You can take the chance. People don't take the chance. They often, not always, but a lot, regret it. Third category, moral regret. If only I'd done the right thing.
Yeah. Daniel, can I just stop you on that one? Because I worry about that one that says more about the personality of the person who's having that regret. So they're sitting there and they're regretting something that didn't happen. And by regretting something that didn't happen means that you're blaming the past for where you are now. There was clearly a process they were going through at that time where they didn't ask the person out, or they didn't do this, or they didn't do that. That was them. And I feel with that category, that is really where you need acceptance of where you are. And that's more of a personality trait, that people are going, I'm going to blame something else, rather than, actually, that was me who made that decision, so that is fine.
Yeah, no, most people actually are not lamenting the outcome. What's nagging at them is the what if, is the what if. The people who said, oh, I met there's somebody who I really wanted to ask out on a date, they are not saying, if I had done that, then I would be married and living a blissful life. They're not saying that. They're saying that there was a moment in my life when I could have actually stepped up and done something, and I didn't do it. And that makes me feel bad because I want to be a kind of person who does things, who actually acts when it's appropriate to act and doesn't chicken out. And so people were actually on boldness regrets much less outcomist than I would have thought. You see this in people starting businesses. They don't say, oh, I wish I had started a business because therefore I would be a gazillionaire. They say, I wish I had started a business because then I might not be in this lackluster job, and at least I would know whether I was could successfully start a business. And so, and even people who started businesses and they failed, relatively few of them were saying, oh, I regret trying to start a business. Mm-hmm. They actually say, I started a business, it failed, I gave it a go, it didn't work out. And so you're right to the extent that when we scrutinize our regrets, we have to go back to the moment of the decision and the person we were at that time. And there's sometimes when you make a decision, you had all the information that you needed, you made a wise decision, and it didn't work out. And actually scrutinizing that makes you realize, hey, that's actually not a regret. That's just circumstance.
Do you think on the boldness category, those sort of things, do you think they've got a lot to do with things like peer group or a religion or politicians or family saying, Because when I wanted to become a TV presenter, I have no right to be a TV presenter, by the way. I don't come from a family of TV presenters, and no one in my family's ever worked in the entertainment industry or anything. And I sort of started telling everybody, and everyone laughed at me, quite rightly, by the way. and I made it, but because I was just a bit strange as a young man and decided that was what I was going to do, and I didn't mind the ridicule. But I mean, a lot of people, that you can't blame them for if they want to step out of their circle, and there's a lot of forces on humans, as I say, peer groups, religion, politicians. In our country, we have a class system. Don't step out of your class. It's, you know, family say don't do this. You know, that we're not. You know, one of my family members said, people like us don't go onto TV, Tim. And it's like, it's nonsense because I'm on TV. But do you think that has in that regret, there's a lot of external factors come into it?
Sure, and I think the regret is that people are held hostage by those external factors, rather than do what you do, which is listen to their inner voice and be true to themselves. You see a lot of regrets about people who are essentially living someone else's life rather than their own life, you know, more broadly. It could be something about boldness. It could be something else. You have some, and I think that's an enormous factor. You see it with people regretting not speaking up, asserting themselves. You see it with certain kinds of identity issues. So we have a decent number of people whose regret is I had a different gender identity, or I had a different sexual orientation than what I was told I was supposed to have, and my regret is that I didn't or wasn't true to myself until much later in life. I wish I had been truer to myself earlier in my life. So I think that's a big. I think that the external forces are what traps people in not being themselves, and ultimately that causes regret.
Yeah, I mean, if you love someone, you have to set them free. I'm thinking about a good example here of someone that I have. As a friend of mine when he was quite young, he came out as gay, and his dad won't really communicate with him. And he sort of regrets telling his dad because he said he could live a secret life. And then I'm sure the dad regrets, or will regret when he's older, losing contact with it. But the dad must, I mean, I don't know why the dad would be like that, but it must be pressure on everyone coming in from all angles. And that must be just filled with regret when things like that happen.
I think that if I had that particular scenario, my hunch is that over time, that dad will have much deeper regret than that son.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Right, let's go on to moral regrets then. What's that? That's the I think that's the third category.
Moral regrets are if only I'd done the right thing. So you're at a juncture. You can do the right thing. You can do the wrong thing. And people do the wrong thing. Not everybody regrets it, but a lot of people regret it. And so in this category, you have things like. Bullying, a lot of regrets around the world about bullying earlier in life, a lot. You have a lot of regrets about marital infidelity. And then you have, it's a smaller category, but it very intensely felt. And then you have a smattering of other kinds of regrets. The interesting thing about this, Tim, is to your earlier point, is that, you know, human beings don't have a single definition of morality. We have some consensus about what is moral behavior, but we don't have full consensus over what is moral behavior. So there's some people who might have a moral regret about something like having an abortion, and lots of people who have absolutely zero moral regret about having an abortion. It doesn't make one person better than the other. It just says that in this particular dimension, they have a different moral code.
Daniel, on this podcast, we did a series of podcasts in the early days a few years ago about having an affair. I just put it out there. I want to know what it's like having an affair. It sounds horrific for me because it sounds like as Mark, my producer at the time, said, feels like a lot of admin. And we got various stories came in. We ran it over three or four weeks. And the reality was, is no one in an affair, anyone in an affair ever had a good time. There was like obviously lust involved and those sort of things, but everybody ended up having a horrific time. And it was just, it's funny you should say that. It was just full of regret because they lost money, houses, children, you know, the love of their life. They lost it all. It was a really, you know, one of those things. But in your book, you talk about there was a TV show in Holland, I believe, which became very successful, ran for many years.
Right.
About where they reunited people who regretted being horrific to other people. But very popular show, because I imagine a lot of people might feel that way.
Yeah, that was it's a great, yeah, it was a popular show for a few years in the Netherlands. You're exactly right. And what it was, let's say that you and I were university friends, but we had some kind of falling out because I insulted you, or I elbowed you out of the way for some campus position or something like that, and you were hacked off at me for years. What I could do is, what they would do is they would bring you onto the show. You would talk about how irritated you were at me, and then they would bring me onto the set, and I could apologize to you, and you could either accept the apology or not. And this is one way that there's certain kinds of regrets of action that we can deal with by undoing them. We can apologize, we can make amends, we can have our no regrets tattoo removed. And so this was a show showing the human need to make amends, to make other people whole, to resolve conflict.
Mm. So is that what the last category is about, or is it slightly different?
The last category is so we have moral regrets. The last category are connection regrets. These are regrets about relationships, all kinds of relationships, not only romantic relationships. In fact, not mostly romantic relationships. It's relationships with our kids, with our parents, with our other relatives, with our friends, with our neighbors, with our colleagues. And it's pretty simple. You have a relationship that was intact or should have been intact, and it comes apart. And it usually comes apart in profoundly undramatic ways. It drifts apart. And one side wants to reach out and says, oh, it's going to be really awkward if I reach out. And besides, the other side's not going to care. So the relationship drifts apart even more. And they say, oh, now it's going to be even more awkward to reach out. And they're even going to care less. And of course, they're completely wrong on both fronts. It's not very awkward, and the other side always cares. And yet, these relationships come apart. And in some very sad circumstances, it's too late, where one of the people dies. And that door has closed, and you can't reach out. So connection regrets are, if only I'd reached out.
I suppose most people start analyze. We've got busy lives, right? That is exactly what happens. You're busy and you forget someone, or you do something, you carry on. You've got to make your money, you've got to pay your mortgage, you've got to bring kids up, or you know, you're starting to your retirement. And I suppose it's only when you're coming towards the end of your life, let's use the cliche deathbed, that you start looking back on these things. And that's when I suppose a few of the things must come through. You always hear the story of the nurse who's in the hospice or something. They speak to the patient, and their regrets are never working, doing more work or buying more cars or going on more holidays. It's always about relationships, generally about, you know, looking after people you're around. But did the you know, that's when life slows down and we start looking back and analyzing where we went and where we didn't go. I wonder if the pandemic had a big effect, because for most of us, our lives completely slowed down for a period which would normally never happen. Was there a massive uptake in your study when suddenly we hit a pandemic and everyone went, hold on, let me analyze my life a bit?
I think you're right. I think people were more likely during the pandemic to stop and reflect, if for no other reason that they had nothing else to do. You know, they had time to reflect. And when people reflect, when they look backward, they often think about regrets, because that's how our brains work. And now the question then becomes, what do you do with those regrets? How do you take those regrets and transform them into a force for good? But I do think that the pandemic was a moment of forced reflection, and reflection often involves regret. And if we learn and if we actually systematically deal with those regrets, we can actually live better lives post-pandemic.
Mm. I suppose one of the things I took from your book was what you're kind of saying is when you're looking at regrets, understanding that's the truth. This is the truth of life. You're starting to look at your regret and you're starting to go, this was the truth. This is what I did and this is why I feel this way. Is that what you're saying? Is it, it's a way of going, let's look at the truth here rather than the fantasy of some fantasy I've made up in my mind. The regret is the truth.
The regret is often the truth. It's something you scrutinize in order to find the truth. But the approach that you're suggesting is exactly right. What you want to do is you want to think about your negative feeling of regret. So this is the thing, Tim. People don't teach us very well how to deal with negative feelings. So some of us ignore negative feelings. We say we put our fingers in our ears and go blah 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 to try to drown it out. That's not a good idea. Others of us become so captured by these negative ideas, they bring us down. We ruminate over them. We wallow in them. That's a bad idea too. What you want to do is exactly what you're suggesting, which is to think about them, to recognize them, to look at regrets. Okay, here we go. Maybe not always as the truth, often as the truth, but regrets are a signal. They're data, they're information, and you have to take it in. You can't reject it and you can't be debilitated by it. You have to take it in. You have to look it in the eye, as I said earlier, and do something about it.
Well, most of the regrets, were they stuff they hadn't done of the 16,000 that you read? I got it right then.
Yeah.
Were they things that they hadn't done or things that they had done? What was the majority of regrets that people hated?
That's a very important question. And the overwhelming numbers were regrets of inaction, regrets of what people didn't do. But as you were saying in one of your earlier questions, or really implying in one of your earlier questions, there was an age difference here. That when people are young, they tend to have equal numbers, roughly equal numbers of action regrets and inaction regrets. Regrets about what they did and regrets about what they didn't do. But as people age, the inaction regrets take over. When you get to be in your 40s, 50s, 60s, it's roughly 2-to-1 inaction regrets over action regrets.
Well, do you think your survey was a bit like your World Regret Survey? Do you think it was a bit like confession? Do you think people loved it because it eases the pain of the regret if I'm sharing it with somebody else?
Yeah, definitely. There's no question about that. I mean, I think that there it's not it, it, the fact that so many people filled out the survey. With very there's basically no promotion, no publicity. I mean, there was no, there were a couple of tweets and a mention in my newsletter. That was it. The fact that people were revealing is you got it exactly right. That there's something in disclosure, in and of itself, that is valuable to people. Disclosure is an unburdening, but also disclosure. When we disclose, we use language, and language is a way to take this amorphous, blobby abstraction of negativity and turn it into concrete words, which are less fearsome. And I think that your point about the confessional is also really interesting too, because going back to this, the big point is that in secular society, we don't really have, no one ever teaches us the mechanisms of how to deal with negative emotions. But religious traditions actually teach us a little bit about that. Catholicism has confessional and repentance. Judaism has a day, single day of the year, where you atone for your sins. But in secular society, we've been sold a bill of goods that we have to be positive all the time. Not most of the time, all the time. We have to be positive all the time. We have to relentlessly look forward. We have to relentlessly look forward rather than backward.
I love that.
Not a healthy recipe for living.
Yeah. 100%. So what are the other things you should do once you've realized that you have a regret and that it's burning away in your consciousness? What are the other ways that you can fix the regret? I'm not sure that's the right way of putting it, but or learn or fix, I'm not sure, but what are the other things you can do?
Yeah. Well, there are a few things. So I would start out by, here's how I look at it. I look at the process as inward, outward, forward. Inward, outward, forward. So inward is how do you look at yourself and your regret? How do you reframe the way you think about your regret and even how you think about yourself? And here's the thing about us human beings. When we talk to ourselves, especially after a misstep or a mistake or screw up, we are brutal. I mean, if you were to broadcast the inner, the self-talk, the way that we talk to ourselves out into the world. Like, if you said that to anybody inside of a company, you'd be fired, you know, you'd be sacked right away. So we don't want to do that. What we want to do is do something called self-compassion, which is a very, very interesting research started about 20 years ago, showing essentially this: treat yourself with kindness rather than contempt. Treat yourself with the same kindness you would treat somebody else. So treat yourself with kindness rather than contempt. Recognize that your missteps are part of the human condition. We tend to think that we're more special than we really are. We tend to think, oh my gosh, I must be the only person who has this regret, because we see this ocean of positivity out there, this performative PR, look at me culture, and we think that somehow we're flawed. We're not. Regrets are part of the human experience. Treat yourself with kindness rather than contempt. Second, outward. We talked about disclosure. You got it exactly right. Disclosure lifts the burden, and by converting it into language, you defang it and can make sense of it. And the third, which is really important, is outward. You got to extract a lesson from it. Okay, so you treat yourself with kindness, you make sense of it, but you got to find a lesson. And here's the thing, another quirk of us human beings. We stink at solving our own problems. We're terrible at solving our own problems because we are. Because we're too close to it. We're too enmeshed in it. When we solve our own problems, we're like scuba divers. We don't, to solve your problems, you don't want to be like a scuba diver. You want to be an oceanographer. You want to zoom out. And so what you do is you do something called self-distancing. All kinds of techniques for self-distancing. So if you are deciding what to do with your regret, Tim, instead of saying to yourself, what should I do? Say, what should Tim do? Talk to yourself in the third person. There's a lot of research showing that that's an effective technique. You could say, what would I, trying to make a decision, what would I tell my best friend to do? All right. That's one of the best decision-making heuristics that there is. Another thing you can do, one of my favorite things for anticipating regret. You can say, I'm about to make a decision. Okay, so here's what I've done. I've forgiven myself, treated myself with kindness, I've disclosed it. Now I'm trying to find out the lesson that I want to learn from this regret. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to consult me of 10 years from now. I'm going to get on Zoom, and I'm going to call me in 2032. I'm going to call Dan in 2032. And he knows what to do. And I can make a very, very strong prediction that the me of 2032 is not going to care about that lunch that I had an hour ago. That me of 2032 is not going to care whether I bought a blue jumper or a green jumper. The me of 2032, you know what it's going to care about? I can make a safe prediction. Did I let a friendship or close relationship drift and not reach out? Did I not act boldly when I had a chance? Did I not do the right thing? If I do the wrong thing, the me of 2032 is going to want to have some words with me. And so when we do this process, inward, outward, forward, we begin to extract lessons from these regrets to do better next time. And this is the key, that if we treat our regrets properly, as you're saying, if we look at them as a signal, as containing some truth to them, we confront them, we look at them like grown-ups, we extract a lesson from them, and we do better in the future. And this is not my theory. That we have 30 years of social science telling us this, that when people confront their regrets, they become better negotiators. When people confront their regrets, they become better problem solvers. When people confront their regrets, they become better strategists. When people confront their regrets, they become better parents. They find more meaning in their life. So there is a pile of evidence showing that this is a transformative emotion if we treat it right.
What I loved in your book was that, or taking this, what you're saying there, and what would I do if I was a doctor, or what would I do if this wasn't my business? What would I do if it was somebody yes. else's business? What would I do with it? And I thought that was a little bit of genius, because you just change the perspective of it and can see it in a much clearer way, can't you?
Absolutely. And that's, I mean, for your business people in the audience, like a great technique, exactly, a great self-distancing technique that you're talking about is to ask yourself, what would my successor do? What would my successor do? Someone's coming in to replace me. What would my successor do? And that's very clarifying, because you're getting out of your own head. Remember, we stink at solving our own problems because we're too close to it. We're too caught up in the details. When we look at the problem, when we look at someone else's problem,
we have that distance, and that distance gives us the perspective that you're talking about.
I absolutely love that technique.
So if you're trying to decide, you know, if you're trying to decide like who your next podcast guests are going to be and you're stuck, you say, okay, what would my successor do? You know, you're going to be booted out of this podcast and you're going to be replaced. What would she do? Who would she book? That's a good way to pick your guests.
She would be saying, Daniel, have you got any contacts to Al Gore? Because I'd really like to get him on the podcast if that's possible. Daniel, do you believe in free will?
Yes. Do you?
No. Well, I don't know because I'm only human. But I don't know. The more I do this podcast, the more I sort of feel that you're put in a certain amount. There's very small amount of you that you can actually control. I was sitting in a sauna the other day, sweating, thinking, I can't stop this. I can't affect my digestive system. I have no idea how my blood's pumping around my body. There's very few bits I can do. And also, I think, you know, I've talked to you, and you've given me the big takeaway from this is going to be that technique of distancing myself. I know I'm going to use it all the time because I think it's absolutely brilliant. So I've now got that programmed into me, hopefully, and that's what happens. And the more I do these podcasts, the more I realize we're a victim of circumstance, where we're born, what our thought processes were, why was it that everyone was laughing at me and ridiculing me, yet I still thought I'm going to go and do it. You know, what created that in me that I'd want to do that? I think I have some answers on it. But so I'm worried that, not worried, but I'm thinking maybe we're more like a computer than we think. We're being programmed by everything around us, and the bit of free will we have is very, very, very small. I don't know why do you think we have it?
Well, I mean, I think that let's go back to your sauna example. All right, you definitely did not have free will over whether you were sweating. No question about that. But I think you had free will about whether you walked into the sauna in the first place. I think you had some free will there. But it's a very interesting paradox, Tim. And actually, in some other survey research that I did a big survey of the U.S. population, and I asked people the question, do you believe that people have free will? I wanted to see, do people believe they have free will, or do people believe that everything happens for a reason? So I asked people, do you in general believe that human beings have free will, that they have control over their decisions, blah, 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 blah. And we got about, I think it was like in the high 70%, maybe 80% said yes. Then I asked people in a different part of the survey, do you think that everything happens in life for a reason? And the opposite question, and we got about 80% of people said yes. The overwhelming majority of people believe in both of those things, that they have free will and that everything happens for a reason, which is, to a rational guy like me, I found initially very annoying, but it might be right it might be right in the sense that I think one of the challenges of life is figuring out exactly what you're talking about, which is how much is circumstance, how much is your own effort. And I don't think we know the answer to that, and it's certainly not only one. What do we have control over and what do we not have control over? That's a very important decision. That's a very important thing to work out. And so this is, to me, another reason why regret clarifies, because when we scrutinize it, we realize what we have control over and what we don't. So I did something called a failure resume where I listed all of my professional failures and screw-ups and mistakes. And then in the next column, I listed what lesson did I learn from it. And in many cases, there was no lesson. The lesson was, sometimes things don't work out. Sometimes you have bad luck. Sometimes shit happens, you know, and you don't have any control over that. And that's actually, knowing what you have control over and what you don't have control over is, I think, an important aspect of human flourishing.
Okay, let me ask you another question then. Obviously, a lot of people have regrets because they didn't stand up and do something, or didn't stand up to someone, or they were shy. There's a lot of that word's used a lot by people. I'm shy. I don't want to put myself out there. A lot of that must be programming from childhood, from society, from peer groups and everything, that you don't have the confidence to do it. Do you think you can go to bed on a Wednesday when we're doing this? I can go to bed tomorrow and I can sit there there at night, lie in my bed and think, tomorrow I'm going to wake up and I'm going to have a different personality? Because I know a lot of people out there think you can do this. Wake up tomorrow and go, now I'm really outgoing. I'm going to be really outgoing and this is my new personality. Can you change that? You don't think so?
No, you cannot.
But that's free will.
No, I don't think you can change that. I don't think you can change that fundamentally. I don't think you can change that fundamentally immediately. But I think that there's no question to me. You can't go to sleep on Wednesday night and say, if you're not very assertive and you have difficulty asserting yourself, you can't go to sleep on Wednesday night and say, I'm now going to be the most assertive person in the world. I'm going to assert myself in every situation. You can't do that. But what you can do is this. You can do smaller things. You can say, you know what? I regret not asserting myself at work. So today, in my 2 o'clock meeting, I'm going to make sure that I speak up. One small thing. You can absolutely do that. And that can embolden you to speak up in the next meeting. Or you could say, you know what? For whatever weird reason, when I'm in line at the coffee place, there are people who are more assertive than I and they're getting in line in front of me. Tomorrow, I'm not going to let that happen. All right? So you're not making a gigantic promise to transform the essence of who you are. You're actually focused on particular behaviors next time. And the dirty little secret here is that if we begin to pile up particular behaviors, that has a fighting chance of altering our personality a little bit.
Right. Okay. So are we, sorry, I'm going to get a bit deep here, but are we born with our personality? Is that what we feel? We're born with we're born with this soul, which then creates the personality around us. And then we have to try and manipulate it to try and get what we want out of life. Am I anywhere close to your thought process on this?
Well, I mean, I think my thought process matters less than the fact that we have an entire field of psychology called personality psychology that has been exploring this for 70 years, showing that it's a mix, that some personality characteristics are innate. So if you look at something like introversion and extroversion, more introverted kids tend to grow up to become more introverted adults, that there's a genetic component there's a genetic component to introversion. But the fact that there's a genetic component to something doesn't mean that it seals your fate. It's going to be a mix of the person and the situation. It's going to be a mix of who you are as a biological creature and the environment that you are in. And so we can do things to move, you know, and also a lot of personality traits are distributed across a bell curve, across a normal distribution. Just take introversion and extroversion. This idea that some of us are entirely introverted and some of us are entirely extroverted is nonsense. It's a spectrum. And so I might be a little bit more at the introverted end of the spectrum. And so you can't transform me into a strong extrovert, but there's certain things I can do to move a little bit more toward the center. There's no question about that. The same thing is true if you're a strong extrovert. If you're a strong extrovert, you're probably not going to have a profession like mine that involves sitting in a room by yourself for long stretches of time. That's probably not your thing. But you can move a little bit more to the center. So there is personality is it's part nature, it's part nurture, it's part biology, it's part circumstance, just like almost everything else.
What are you going to do with the coming to the end of the hour now? What are you going to do with all these regrets from the? Are you going to keep it going? Well regret survey. Will you keep that going? Because it seems quite important.
I'm going to keep it going for a while. In part because we get a lot of traffic of people who are just interested in contributing, but also interested in reading. Because on this site, when our back-end code is actually working effectively, you can click on a map, a world map, and go to Uganda. What do people in Uganda regret? And see the last several entries from Uganda. You can go, forgive the parochialism, you can go into the U.S. and look at U.S. states and Canadian provinces. So you can say, you know, what do people in California regret? What do people in Texas regret? You can go, we didn't separate out Great Britain by Scotland, Wales, England, so you have the entire UK there. But you can see, we have about 1,000 regrets from the UK. You can see some of those there too. So I'm inclined to keep it up. I think it's pretty interesting, and I think people find it valuable.
Yeah, I suppose if you've got some burning regret that you had since you were younger, and then you read that somebody else has got the same regret, like a problem halved is a problem shared, maybe it's kind of that same sort of theory, is it? The more you see other people have the same regret, the lesser impact it has on you as a person.
Absolutely right. And that's part of self-compassion, is recognizing that our mistakes and our regrets are part of the human condition. I mean, I can speak to that personally. So I have regrets from earlier in my life about kindness. I was never a bully, but I was in many situations where people were not being treated well. They were being excluded or not being treated fairly. I saw it happening, and I didn't do anything. And that bugs me. And it's bugged me for a long time. However, I did feel slightly more normal when I looked at the 16,000 regrets, or you know, these thousands and thousands of regrets that came in, and realized that I am certainly not the only one with that regret. It's many people have that kind of regret. And so that helps me treat myself with kindness, disclose it and make sense of it, and extract a lesson from it. And even that's a good, again, I think even though my regret about lack of kindness shows you why regret is important. It clarifies things. The fact that this regret stuck with me for, like in some cases, 30 years, the fact that this regret stuck with me clarifies what I value. I value kindness. It revealed to me that I actually value kindness more than I might have consciously realized. Second, it instructs me on what to do next, which is to treat people with greater kindness.
Yeah, very wise words. There's no such thing as a perfect human. I know that. But sadly, social media, especially if you're in the spotlight, social media says unless you're perfect, you know, we don't like you. We're not going to take the 100%. We're only going to take the 1% of something you did, and that's it. And sadly, a lot of people have come unstuck with that in the last few years. Daniel, it's been wonderful speaking to you. I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. We've gone all over the place with it, which I think is a sign of a good conversation. Enjoy London. I hope you have a good time over here. I wouldn't go back for the chicken, because if they can't make steak and cheese well, they're definitely not going to make any chicken well.
Okay, I'll make a note of that. I'll make a note of that. So no chicken, and then get an umbrella. Everything will be fine.
When you come to Britain, you always have to have waterproof clothes, because that's what it is. We're an island under a shower.
I know.
Thank you so much, Daniel. Thank you for joining me today. Your book, by the way,
all right. Thank you, Tim. It's been a pleasure.
All right. It's called The Power of Regret. Just tell, if people want to follow you, where do they go on social media? Where's the best place to go if they want to follow you?
Well, the book is called The Power of Regret: How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. You can find me on danpink.com or on Twitter at Daniel Pink.
Okay, and where do they
Instagram at Daniel Pink?
And if they want to put a regret, do they just go to your social media?
Oh,
and it's
go
all
to worldregretsurvey.com. worldregretsurvey.com.
Thank you so much. Brilliant. Cheers, Daniel. Thank you.